Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is Don't Tell Me the Score, the podcast that uses sport to explore life's bigger questions. My name is Simon Mundy, and each week I sit down with an expert, from the biggest sporting names in the world to Buddhist monks, neuroscientists, psychologists, and philosophers. We discuss a theme that tells us something insightful and important about life and how best to live it, from the importance of self-acceptance to facing addiction and developing resilience, right through to getting your circadian rhythms in sync and how to sleep better. Sport is a metaphor for life, and in this podcast, I aim to prove that right. I always like hearing from you, so the best way to get in touch is via my website, simonmundy.com, or I'm at Simon Mundy on social media. In this episode, I'm talking to one of England's greatest cricketers, Jos Buttler, and the theme is exploration. Jos Buttler, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Pleasure to talk to you. How's the family?
My family's good, thanks. I've left the IPL and they managed to come out for the whole time with me, which was great. Obviously spending lots of time in bubbles at the moment, as we all are in cricket, but it was great to have my family with me. So everyone's well, thanks.
I've got to say, you and Louise have inspired me somewhat. Obviously, your wife is a Pilates teacher, and Pilates helped me previously. I used to have a dodgy back, and because of lockdown, I'm spending too much time sat down. So the old back's starting to play up a bit. So you've inspired me to go back towards Pilates to try and fix that. So first things first, thank you to you and to her.
Yeah, it's been great. I've the same. That's what I've been doing. I've got a dodgy back as well. So she's done really well. And yeah, I'm glad it's working for you as well.
It does make a real difference, doesn't it, for things like dodgy backs? It's highly recommended. Whenever anyone says to me they've got a gammy back, I'm always like, try Pilates.
Absolutely, yeah. So, and I think, you know, loads of time, especially in professional sport as well, we think about trying to get fit and needing to do high intensity, hard workouts, etc. But so, you know, sometimes the little prehab things, Pilates and yoga, is time well spent for a lot of us.
Do you still do it even when she's not with you?
I do, yes. So now she's throughout the lockdown, obviously taking it all online and stuff. So I can travel with it and try and make sure I do it every day. I really notice the difference now if I don't do it. So it's become a bit of a part of my routine.
Well, it's going to become part of mine again. So thank you for that. Right. Like I said, I'm thrilled to have you on, not least actually because, and this is slight blow my own trumpet stuff here, because you were actually, I tweeted once, because you've listened to a fair few of the old back catalogue of Don't Tell Me the Score.
I have, yeah. We get lots of time travelling and time on aeroplanes or going for a run and listening to a podcast. So some of the guests that you've interviewed, I've loved listening to their stories. I think the one I tweeted you about was the Clive Woodward one, wasn't it? You know, and his teacup theory about just, you know, just thinking about situations and that allowing you to probably have a better chance of succeeding in them. I thought that was a very obvious one. All of us.
Is that something you do? You know, you prep for, you plan and visualize forward?
Yeah, I think, you know, planning has obviously become a big part of it. And I think visualization has been something over the last couple of years I've sort of got into. Worked with a psychologist about visualizing things and you know, like anchoring systems and sort of those. And you know, as we all say, a lot of the time when you have seen it happen, it seems you're more capable of doing it. So just trying to visualize certain situations before a match or before a series and visualizing certain bowlers, I've found that a really powerful tool.
Yeah, and it's a skill, isn't it? Some people take to it really naturally, but others not so much so. I struggle somewhat, but if you practice at it, you get better. Have you found you've improved at it?
Yeah, I think I have improved at it. And I think it's the same as everything. You're having to have the patience to stick with it for long enough. I try and use meditation as well. And that's something that, you know, has taken time to practice. And you know, your thoughts are just wandering. And then, you know, you're meditating, you're not really meant to be thinking of anything. But you know, I think as well, it's how you judge those things. It's so I use visualization as something to give me what I perceive as the best chance of success. It doesn't guarantee me runs, or it doesn't guarantee me keeping wicket really well, and you can't really judge it on that end result. You know, I think that's sometimes where you lose patience with those kind of things, is that you do it, you feel great, you go to the game and get out first ball, or you don't feel good and they think, well, I'm not going to do that again, because it obviously doesn't work. But you know, it's actually having the patience to continue with it, and if you feel a real benefit, and making sure you do it no matter what the end product is of your runs tally as such.
So process over outcome. Just really quickly, what type of meditation, or would you just follow your breath, that type of thing?
Yeah, just the simple ones on Headspace I try and use, and I think a lot of time as well I quite like it. And when traveling and you sort of get sucked into spending time on your phone or watching things. So just a bit of time just with your own thoughts and just getting away from technology is probably one of the big things I use it for.
Oh, totally. Yeah. We it's so easily drawn to our phones, aren't we? Whenever we have a feeling of boredom or anything like that. But like you say, actually sitting with your own thoughts is a very valuable thing to do. And actually Andy Puddicombe, he's been on Don't Tell Me the Score as well. He was in the early in the series. Fantastic, lovely fella. Right, so listen, I've got a couple of quotes that I want to throw at you, Joss. So Stuart Broad described you as England's best ever white ball cricketer. Nasser Hussain, a freak who does freakish things. a mate of mine who's a huge cricket fan, I was chatting to him, that John is his name, and he said one of the most exciting batsmen in full flow ever. So three resounding positive descriptions there. But the thing I think is interesting about you is the talent is obvious, but you're clearly valued in the dressing room. And as you know, with this, it's between the ears that counts as well. So what proportion of your success is down to, do you think, your mental side and that kind of thing?
Probably quite a lot. And I'd say I've sort of learned that over time about how to improve the mental side of things and experience and how to use experience. You know, experience is such a valuable tool, which you can probably accelerate, but you can't just get it tomorrow. You know, you need to go through certain situations and know how it made you feel, or certain moments in games and learn from that. And I think one thing I've got better at, probably as I got to sort of 26, 27, is that my learning, I thought, became better. I think as a young kid, you're right, I thought I was talented and I believed that, you know, you could either do it or you couldn't. And all the older players would say, you know, as you get experience, you'll understand this situation. And I used to think that's a bit of a cop-out sometimes. You know, you see these young players around the world who could do it. And I've certainly learned that as a huge process. And I think one thing I've sort of understood, and I try and when I talk to sort of the younger players now, is how can you accelerate that process? I think for me, Joe Root was a bigger example. For me, you know, we're the same age, but sort of at 21, 22, it felt like he had a 30-year-old's head on his shoulders, whereas I was nowhere near that. And I think how do you quicken up that process of learning and making yourself almost a more experienced cricketer without the experience that you've just gained over time?
So how would you advise someone do that then? And I guess you can, again, apply this in any area of life. How can you become a quicker learner?
Yeah, I think for me, one big thing was is not trying to please people. So I listen to certain people, and you know, lots of people, you know, might have a name that they've scored so many test runs or ODI runs, and you just suddenly are drawn to them and believe what they're saying, and actually then go and you're almost pleasing that person by using whatever their advice was. But actually the learning process of trying to listen, potentially try it in the nets or try it if it's a mental side of thing, but having the confidence and self-belief in your own ability to say, you know what, actually I don't think that works for me, and I'm going to leave that, because, or it might just confirm the opposite, you know, actually he thinks that, but I know that that doesn't work for me. So you can almost move on from that sort of side of thinking and then come back to it. And I think that's been a big part of it, is trying not to please others and just believing that someone has the answers because they're one of the best players to have played the game. Sometimes the guys who weren't the best players are the ones with some of the best information, because they knew that they couldn't do it. They, you know, they've had to learn and think through it and think, why couldn't I do it? And I think I've sort of less ego in terms of the learning as well.
Interesting. So being the judge of what is right for you, listening to your intuition. And that got me thinking, because obviously during the IPO, everyone was talking about where you should bat, and everyone was sticking their oar in. And I was actually going to ask you, you know, how do you react to have everyone chipping in with their opinion? But actually, you've just answered it then, is to take it on board, but ultimately listen and listen to your own sense of what's right for you.
Yeah, and I think you have to, and I think you have to be really strong with that. Now, Owen Morgan in our side is a really good friend as well, and I think he's one of the best at, you know, taking emotion out of decisions as well, and listening and thinking logically through it, and then coming to a conclusion and trusting it. You know, so I'm more of a ditherer sometimes over situations or feelings, and so sometimes talking to him is just clarifies things for me, and I think that's really important as well. Sometimes in those situations, lots of people talk, you have a couple of really close people who you really trust, and if you're feeling like it's affecting you, you can just go to, you know, pick up the phone and just have a little conversation, and hearing it from someone else will sometimes give you clarity. And I think also just individually coming back to what's, especially now, being what's served me well over time, what's important to me, and allowing other people to talk, you know, that's sometimes people in the media, that's their job to discuss it. As a coach and a captain, that's their job to come up with the best team. My job is to just try and do the best I can when I get out there and get my opportunity. So sort of trying to come back around and come back to that point.
Yeah, controlling the controllables, essentially focusing on what's within your power of control. Right, so we've touched on it a little bit insofar as you were a prodigious talent growing up. But actually, before I ask you about that, you had a lovely picture on your Instagram of you and your brother at the 1999 World Cup. What do you remember of that experience? And sitting here now as a World Cup winner, the player who took the bails off to secure England the World Cup, you know, a regular for England, all the three formats, thinking back to that when you would have been, what, 9 years old, what would that nine-year-old part of you have made of what you've go on to achieve now? Would he have believed that it was possible?
Yeah, I think certainly had the dreams, but maybe didn't quite believe it was possible back then. As a nine-year-old, I just loved cricket. I loved all sports. I think that 99 World Cup had a real impact on me as well. You know, getting to, you know, I think you had to go and ballot to get tickets, and my parents, but we got lots of tickets for lots of game, and all of us as a family would go to different games, or if it was, you know, we had so many tickets, it'd be me and mum went to this one, my brother and sister and dad would go to another one, and just managing to see world-class players in front of your own eyes and not really understanding who they were or anything about that, but just had a real great effect on me. And then I think then, yeah, like you say, it's pinch yourself moments really when you think, got 20 years down the line, that's you on the field, and there'll be other kids around the country having those same experiences, and it'd be the start of their dreams of getting there. So and I think around that time, I always loved sport, but I probably wasn't thinking about becoming professional, or that was a realistic thing, until I sort of got onto Somerset's Academy a little bit older, and I sort of felt like I could see a real path with how I was going to get there. So probably as a 9-10 year old, it was more just like the fun of playing cricket and pretending you were, I don't know, Sachin Tendulkar in the Garden, or Waka Yunus bowling or something, and being able to see those names in front of you as a kid, it made them real.
as I mentioned, you were this prodigious talent at school, but to what degree is this right insofar as I know your average was up near 100, but it wasn't just about getting runs insofar as you were very experimental. So you went for the scoop shot, for example, an unorthodox shot when you were sort of 14, 15. And that struck me as the trait of someone who was looking to the future, of trying things out with a view to becoming as rounded a player as possible. So were you forward looking at that time rather than just thinking, oh, I can dominate this school and dominate that school?
I think so, to an extent. And I think that partly is born in just the sort of way I liked watching sports. I always liked the guys who could do something a bit different. You know, you'd listen to the commentary and say, this guy's ahead of his time, or he's the only guy in the world who can do this. And I sort of really liked those players and was always drawn to those players. And I think I enjoyed, you know, one of the best things for me is always the practice and the fun in the nets. You know, there's no consequence. You can get out as many times as you like, and being experimental and trying to try new things and think logically through them as, you know, if I could do this shot, you know, that would bring in another shot into my game, or they never put a fielder there. Why don't I try and hit the ball there in a certain way? And I think the scoop shot as well, sort of, I was trying around with it. And then I remember Sri Lankan player Tilakratne Dilshan was in England in a T20 World Cup, maybe in sort of 2009 sort of time. He was like one of the first guys. He was like going right down and the ball would literally be about to hit his head. And I think then again, it was like, oh, he's doing that. They're saying he's forward thinking. How can he then build on that as well? So I was always drawn to those players who could do things a bit differently.
So would you encourage risk taking and trying these new type of skills, obviously using cricket as an example, but for anyone who wants to become really excel at any particular thing, to put that effort in to broaden your skills and be a bit different and go a bit outside of the ordinary when you're in the developmental stage?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially in that developmental stage and that practice stage, and I think it's really important to try things, because it also, I mentioned a bit, it gives you confirmation either way as well. Because you might try something and you may have wondered about it for a little while and go, actually, that really doesn't work for me, or I don't feel comfortable doing that. So you can sort of leave it and say, I've tried it, it wasn't for me, I'm going to look at something else or a different way of doing it. So but that's the real fun part in the game. You know, we all started playing these games because we had fun, and that exploration and a kid playing a game is now again another really nice mindset for me to come back to, which, you know, sort of feeling under pressure or worrying about my technique. And you sort of go, well, when I was 12, 13, 14, maybe even younger, you had no inhibitions or worries about those things. And trying to take yourself back to that mindset, especially in practice, is a really powerful tool. And it's really fun. You know, I think that's one thing in professional sports. Sometimes you get caught up in the seriousness of it and the pressures. And lots of people talk about the pressures, but it's so fun, and working on your skill and trying to master your particular skill is where the real fun is.
Yeah, not losing touch with that part of us that is all about exploration and growth. And lots of talented youngsters, though, don't make it. Oftentimes, talent is seen as something of a millstone around someone's neck. I spoke to Carol Dweck, who came up with the growth mindset and fixed mindset studies, and a fixed mindset being around thinking your talents are fixed. And people who are talented, oftentimes, as they rise the ranks and it becomes more difficult and their perceived level of talent becomes a bit more challenged than perhaps when it was young, it can become a something that people struggle to then push on and kick on. But clearly in your case, you were marked out as a talent early doors, and you've gone and completely fulfilled that talent and are continuing to do so. Why do you think you weren't a talent casualty, if you like? And have you seen others who perhaps were marked out for great things fall by the wayside?
Yeah, I think you do, especially in cricket, growing up through the ranks, and you come to sort of the games against different counties or the England age group stuff. So you always see some guys and you think, well, this guy's going to go on and be the next Ian Bell or the next Andrew Strauss or Alice. And then, you know, a few years later, they just never seem to kick on. And there's also, like you say, late developers who really sort of surprise you. You think, oh, when we were young, he wasn't that good, but now he's very good. So I think, like you say, it's a real mix of things that you need to make it. I think one of the big things you need around that talent is that real drive to make the best of yourself and to become one of the best. And like you say, when your talent gets challenged, that's when you need that inner drive that you want to push through it and you want to get to the next stage and you want to, okay, at the moment this isn't working. And it's that real hunger, I think, for me, is to try and fulfill my potential. Like you said, I feel like I've got so much talent, and it's like, how am I not going to waste it? What else do I need to make sure I can try and make the most of my talent? And I think it's sometimes a hard thing as well, because you feel like you may never fulfill that, but I want to get to as close as I feel like I could get to. And I think your mindset and your drive to, for me, to make the most of what I've got and make the most of myself is the one thing that really, alongside your skills and your things, will keep pushing you through the tougher times.
Is it a challenge, though, keeping that side up, to make the most of your talent? Because it sounds like there is pressure almost, or self-induced pressure somewhat, or could be endemic in that, whilst staying in touch with the other side we mentioned, that childish or childlike side that's really into exploration and growth. Is it a challenge marrying those two, or can they be complementary?
I think, like you say, a bit of both. They can really complement each other, because it can give you trust and belief that, okay, this is a difficult period, but I've got the talent and the drive to bring me through it. Or when I come into the next challenge, I've got those two things that can help me. I think one thing is tough sometimes is when people get labeled a certain way. Oh, he's a talented player, but he doesn't do enough of X, Y, or Z, or he hasn't quite got this, which so and so. And then that's when, you know, sometimes you can start judging yourself about certain things, or this guy's never made the most of his talent. And sometimes you still hear that with, you know, some really successful players, and you know, they're going really well, and people still say, oh, he should have been better, or he could have been better. And I think that can sometimes eat away at you as an individual, to think that, you know, other people are then starting to judge you about, you know, maybe you're not actually as talented as they believe you are, or maybe there's other factors that are holding your development back, or holding your particular performance at a certain time back. So I think that, again, that's where you need that strong mentality, because if you don't quite have that to fight through tough times, or when people are criticizing you, maybe that's something that's where you really need the two to marry up and shine through.
It's not just about talent, isn't it? There's so much goes into making the most of what you have. And it's so easy. I hear this a lot. People getting labeled as, you know, or they're mentally weak, or, you know, they haven't fulfilled their talent. But there's so much that goes into it. It's not just about, you know, the way one hits a ball or anything like that. Something else, though, I thought interesting about your approach was, you're sort of creative in terms of where you look for resources. So I know you've looked at other sports, haven't you, to try and bring in things from other sports to help you with your cricket. And so one thing I saw was even the way you set up for a shot has been influenced by baseball. So A, is that, to what degree is that true? And then B, you know, where did the inspiration to look outside of the normal boundaries of what people expect in cricket to get things from other areas? Where did that come from?
I think, again, for me, that's that just curiosity and exploration side of, like, how do people do things differently? Or is there, you know, there's an obvious correlation between baseball and cricket, especially now with more T20 around, people trying to hit the ball harder and more sixes, and how do they create their power? So I've done a little bit with a few guys, but it's more from sort of the positioning of how you get into that sort of baseball strike, and then how do I gain much power? And then learn you working with your strength and conditioning coach about specific drills that will potentially aid you in that. So then that exploration and curiosity can just continue through, you know, into a number of different people. And then how do I bring that certainly into my cricket? Or so, and I think, again, it comes from looking at other sports just as a sports fan. I like looking at different sports. I follow lots of sports and following the best players around the world, and you read so much about them. And there's always, I feel like, a certain consistent trend about the best players. They do certain things really well. They look after themselves. They look for new things, new invention. They're always looking to challenge convention. And I think then sort of bringing that mindset in, well, if it's good enough for the best guys in the world in that, and it confirms that also that should be the way things should be in your sport.
What you've just said there reminds me of what Jason Kerrs, who he was the academy director at Somerset, where you joined the academy there at age 13. And he said what impressed him most about you was your character, but your willingness to learn and your hunger for knowledge. So it's this attitude that you have, this looking for improvement in any areas, down the back of the sofa, in the cupboard, in other sports, wherever it may be. This is a deep-rooted thing for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I think that's the, again, like that curiosity side. And I think what I was talking about earlier on when we were saying about how you learn better, you know, sometimes you can sort of drown yourself in knowledge and sort of that thirst for knowledge and actually forget about yourself and you as the individual and what you do. So that's the balance that I didn't always have and I've tried to get better at in terms of learning. But I found it fun as well. I find it fascinating to listen to players. One of the best things about the IPL for me is you can just watch people train. You know, you get to go to the ground with you, guys that you wouldn't normally play with and other guys who are the best in the world. And in a lot of the time, like two sides will be training at the ground at the same time and just watching people do things that, you know, you can learn so much from just watching and not always having to ask questions about things. And that's interesting how he does this or that particular drill that he's working on for that particular shot. Maybe that's something I could bring into my game. And like you say, as a youngster on the academy, I was very lucky that someone like Jason Kerr was very sort of provided a environment where we were all encouraged to learn and to push boundaries and to try and, you know, one of his big things was, you know, when you're training around the second team and the first team, why is someone on the academy not be doing something better than they're doing? You know, why does it have to, we just follow their path? You know, why can't you challenge them to be, you're training harder than them or you're doing a drill that they should be doing and stuff. So I thought that was a really good way of looking at it as well as a youngster.
I'll come to the IPL in a mo, but in terms of your international career, so you made T20 international debut age 20, one day age 21. Was it 23 or 24 when you were test debut?
I think 24, I'd say.
24. So you moved fast, didn't you? When you did each step up, throughout your career, first of all, A, were there anxieties about am I good enough, which is a very normal thought or feeling to have as you take a step up in class? And B, each time you did progress, did you take the time to sort of pat yourself on the back and acknowledge, okay, here is another step up, well done me?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I certainly had anxieties and that nervous feeling when I was starting out. I remember my T20 debut really well and walking into a dressing room with Graham Swan, Kevin Peterson, Stuart Broad was the captain. And, you know, these are guys I've been watching on the TV for years. And then suddenly you're in the same dressing room as, you know, actually felt a bit out of place. You know, you feel like I shouldn't really be here. I'm not on these guys' level. So it certainly took me some time going into international cricket. And I was lucky that I felt that the England side stuck with me for long enough. In my first year of T20 cricket, I barely scored a run, really, and I batted down the order and didn't get loads of opportunities. But I wasn't doing much, really, to sort of warrant investment in myself. But I remember really clearly I scored 30 runs off, I think, 11 or 12 balls in a T20 against South Africa. And that was the moment for me where it felt like I proved to the dressing room that I could do it. And I think it wasn't about the media or the fans or anyone else. It was sort of proving to myself and to the guys in the dressing room, you sort of get that acceptance of, okay, he's good enough to be here. And I think that was a really big moment for me as a young player, is earning that respect of the dressing room.
Yeah.
They may never have even been thinking those things, but it certainly made a big impact for me to sort of feel like now they've seen that I can do it.
So self and colleagues, I mean, I think, again, that's something that we can all relate to, but you do have the added pressure of the fans and the media. But speaking of the media, just to fast forward to the Ashes 2015, which I know was a bit of a harrowing time, because I know you don't feel like you played your best, and that's in your own words. England did win that series. You know, how did it feel feeling personally dissatisfied with how you played, yet at the same time being part of a winning team?
Yeah, good, great question. It's a really strange one sometimes. I think actually I look back with great memories of what the team achieved, but obviously disappointment in sort of my part in that, you know, and like you say, when you're looking for that respect of your teammates, sometimes I feel like, well, I was a bit of a passenger really through that series in the way I played, and I didn't contribute loads to that series win. So it gives you a bit of an empty feeling when you look at your individual stuff. But you know, one of my favorite things about this, so you look around at some of the achievements of some of the other guys, and it's just amazing to be on the field for those moments, or in the dressing room watching, you know, Joe Root score another 100 or whatever. So being a part of that side, you know, there's some special memories, but they weren't sort of individual memories of me doing great things. So, and I think cricket is a strange one in that sense, that it's such an individual sport in a team environment. You know, you're very much, as a batter, you're on your own really, and it's down to you as an individual. Obviously, you're part of a bigger team. And the same with the bowlers at times. So yeah, cricket is a strange one in that sense. And I also think, having won the series, you know, and then almost after that, you know, people saying like, what's your favourite thing you've done in cricket? And I almost felt obliged to say winning the Ashes in 2015, because it's obviously such a big thing for everyone, win the Ashes, and I'm so lucky to be part of a winning side. But it was almost kidding myself, because I said, actually, I went through it finding it so tough and not actually that enjoyable, and got dropped from the team soon after.
Just to zero in on one person's criticism, so Geoffrey Boycott, he really did lay it on thick. He was saying things like, I mean, very typical Boycott stuff, you know, rabbit in headlights, pathetic 7-year-old schoolboy, all that kind of stuff. Now, I know what it's like, and we can all relate to this these days, you know, on focusing or being hard to shut out negative feedback. So, you know, I get messages about my podcast, and most of them are really nice and they're lovely to receive, and you get the odd one that isn't, and it tends to stick in your mind. But those are messages that only I get to see, let alone feedback that would be headlining, for example, the BBC Sport website. So how did it feel having someone pile in like that? And I know you weren't alone, but how did it, were you able to stop it impacting you too much?
I'd probably say at that stage of my career, not really. I'd say I probably was quite aware of it. Like you say, in this day and age, it's very tough to shield yourself from everything that's going on social media. You know, somehow it gets to you. But I'd say back then, I probably would let that kind of thing affect me, and I'd probably let kind of things like the opposition would say to you sort of affect you. And, you know, so I think it is tough. And I remember that particular series, I talk about that learning. Everyone built the Ashes up so big, and I almost was like, God, I need to change everything I'm doing. Now Mitchell Johnson's coming, and X, Y, Z, I obviously can't do this, and focused a lot on negatives of myself, as opposed to the how can I score runs, or this is my strength, etc. And then I'd let that drip feed into me from like the media. You know, a lot of the time in the dressing room, the TVs are on, and you know, you come in at lunch and someone's doing a 10-minute piece on why you're not scoring any runs, and you know you don't want to watch it, but then obviously there's that curiosity in the mind of, actually, what are they saying? I wonder what they're talking about. So I'd say it is tough to shut out at times, and especially when it's well-respected people. And I know Geoffrey Boycott's quite outspoken on certain things. He sort of takes things with a pinch of salt. But especially if it's someone you really respected and liked as a player before, who's then having to give you some criticism, you know, sometimes that can really affect you. But one real coping mechanism I've sort of tried to use is to understand that's people's job, you know, especially the guys in the commentary box or writing the newspaper articles. That is his job, to give his opinion. It doesn't mean it's right, but that's what he gets paid to do. So to let them do that and sort of not judge that, you know, it's not a personal thing. I think that's sometimes a struggle, is you sort of take things very personally. It's, and you know, doesn't make me a bad person that I had a bad cricket match. Yeah. You know? So to try and separate the two as well and not let it affect your life like that.
Yeah, that separating of the two is absolutely crucial, isn't it? And it does strike me that you're good at doing that. And I'll come to your perspective, because there are a lot of sports people who struggle, for example, when they retire. And, you know, obviously a lot of their identity and self-worth is really bound up in what you do. But it does strike me that you're quite adept at separating just the cricketer or someone who plays cricket from just the person. Is that accurate?
I think so. It's something I try and work on and try and remind myself of a lot. You know, a simple analogy of sort of, you know, picking up a newspaper. If you start at the start, you know, by the time you get back to the sports pages, you realize that, you know, not getting any runs last night is not really that much of an issue in terms of things. But that's also a challenge at times, because in my life, sometimes that is a big issue and there are knock-on effects potentially in certain things that it can have. So I think you have to find a balance in those kind of things. But perspective, I think, is really important. And I like trying to find, you know, where does cricket sit for me in my life? It's obviously a huge thing and it's my thing, and I try and be the best I can be at it. But really, in the grand scheme of the world, and especially at the moment, you know, the things that have been going on from COVID, it certainly makes you take stock and say, actually, you know what, it's not. There are other things that have huge amount of value that I have in abundance, and they're not anything to do with cricket.
And does that outlook paradoxically help you play better?
I think at certain times, yes. I think it allows you some freedom. I think it allows you, it feels like you've got space to breathe sometimes. We can heap pressure on ourselves. But one thing, you know, you always talk about when someone's in the zone and it just talks about, you know, the post-match interview is always the same, isn't it? You know, I wasn't really thinking anything. I was clear. I everything, you know, so how do you get in that zone? And a lot of time you need the freedom of thought to be there. A lot of the time, if you're thinking about technical thoughts or someone writing thing in the media and say, it's just detracting energy from actually your focus needs to be just watching the ball and reacting onto certain different things. And I think that perspective does give you freedom to play, because it like coming back to that child mentality, you know, in the garden with your brother, you've got absolutely no worries, you're just playing the game. And I think that, again, though it's a professional job, trying to remember you are playing a game and to see it as that for as much as you can.
To what degree then do you think pressure is self-induced by the way you think and the way you look at things?
I think certainly to an extent you can enhance pressure and heighten, you know, you can make it a bigger situation than sometimes it is, and then other times you can make it not as much, you know, actually it is a big thing and you feel like, oh, it's not. So and I've certainly never been perfect in this kind of thing. I know I had lots of talks with the psychologists actually throughout the World Cup, and especially sort of before the final, sort of thinking, if tomorrow doesn't go how I want it to, I don't know how I'd sort of carry on, you know. So in that sense, I was making it the biggest thing in my whole life at that point. So I've certainly drip into the wrong side of those things sometimes. But then, you know, over time we spoke about, okay, well, what can you control? Can you come back to the game tomorrow and do your visualization stuff, get in the perfect zone you can be that's allowed you to perform so well in the last year and a half, 2 years? Now, all you have to do really is bring that tomorrow. That's the only thing I could actually do and control. So that the pressures, of course, of the outcome are different at times, but actually what I can do to affect that at my best is always the same.
So focusing on the things you can control. And in the moment, you spoke there a minute ago about not thinking too much, for example, about technique or about what people have said or written. So how have you been able to develop that power of focus? And what are you focusing on when you're out there batting in a consequential situation? And how would you develop that power of focus?
So my focus when I'm at my best is always about game situation. Especially that's why I've naturally found sometimes one day cricket easier than test cricket, because the situation is sort of laid on in front of you a lot of the time. So say for a 50 over match, when I come into bat, we need 120 runs off 20 overs. So I know straight away what the situation dictates of the way I have to play. So that's always sort of my focus is trying to think outwardly about game situation. And then trust is a huge one to feel like, okay, I trust myself that I have all the tools and all the right things I need to be able to achieve that, and then to allow it to happen. Your subconscious brain is so powerful, and especially in cricket, I've hit millions and millions of cricket balls over my lifetime. So what's different, the way I should going to react to this particular ball? There's it's all ingrained within you. You've done all the work, so allow yourself to be in the game of what's happening on this particular day, and focusing on game situation and gameplay is always, when I'm at my best, the sort of things I focus on. So sometimes in test cricket I find it over 5 days, so you're on day one, and sometimes there's so many ways that the game can unfold, so sometimes I find that it's not a very clear picture, and then I sometimes get confused of how should I play at this particular moment, whereas in one day cricket it's usually a little bit easier.
When someone is bowling the ball at you at 90 mile an hour plus, and there's such a difference watching it on TV to being, first of all, watching it from the stands, and then I imagine even more being out there in the middle. The first time I remember seeing a match live, I was like, couldn't believe how fast they're coming. Is it totally instinct? Are you almost surprised at what you're doing with the ball sometimes?
Sometimes, and I think sort of for me, that purest form of batting, like I say, is when your subconscious is in complete control and you're almost a spectator of your own body almost, aren't you? I think that for me is the zone, sort of, that you have no real thoughts, and it's complete trust in your body and in your practice and in everything that you've trained for, that whatever this ball comes down, I will react. My body will do it for me if I allow it to. So I think that's sort of the purest form of batting for me. And I think trust is a huge part of that. You have to trust that you've done the work and you've done the ugly training at times, to face 90 miles an hour in the nets or some uncomfortable practices is never very fun, actually. But if you can get through that and in the practice, and it takes you, in that game situation, you've done the work and have given myself the best chance of succeeding. And then allowing your talent to do the job for you, allowing all those, that muscle memory and that subconscious thought to take over.
I love that sort of idea. You practice and practicing hard and refining your skills and putting yourself under uncomfortable situations in practice, and then going out and ultimately letting go and surrendering. That seems to be a real formula for success in across all sports and in most things, actually. I mean, for me, if I think of preparing for a podcast, I know if I do the prep, if I do the work, and then you let go, it's such a formula for success, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And like I say, think listening to podcasts and reading certain things and looking at different sports, that, like you say, it's that common trend that the majority of successful people do. And so you look at certain businesses and why this guy is so successful, it's like you say, it's that they do the work and then they let things happen, and they have trust that it will happen, and they trust the people around them that they've done their work. And especially in team sports, and sort of like you say, that we've all done the stuff, we're all prepared, we're good to go, let's now go out and let it happen.
Just a quick thing on perspective, you're well known for having F it written on your bat. Is that still the case, and where did that come from?
Yeah, it is still the case, and I've had it on there for a while, actually. And I go back to my sort of T20 debuts and stuff. I struggled a little bit to start with, and Mark Borden was the England psychologist at the time. I remember sitting down with him in a hotel in Manchester and just saying, I feel like this is kind of happening, and I don't feel like I'm in the best headspace when I'm at the games at the moment. And we went through a little bit of it, and almost that inverted youth, that sort of arousal level stuff. Yeah. Sort of saying, where do you sit on this when you're at your best? What do you sort of, when you're at your best, what do you say to yourself? And I said, I literally just say effort. And he was like, well, that, that is it. Your effort mindset is pretty much you at your best. So that's the sort of thing you need to remind yourself of. How can you practice that mindset, and how can you try and turn up to games and bring that into your games? And then so I started writing on the top of my handle as just a little reminder, when you look down and take your guard, it's there, or through at the non-striker's end. And then I think over time it's taken on more meanings, like I said, about perspective. It can take on lots of that. And you sit down after you got out and you look at it and you just think, effort doesn't matter that much in the grand scheme of life. Yeah. Certainly find it helps a lot around commitment, like for me. So like I say, if I'm trying to weigh up a situation in the middle and, well, this bowler's got a certain field, I feel like he's gonna bowl this, or I need to play this shot, and when that guy on your shoulder is sort of coming in and saying, yeah, but what if, it's almost, that's the time when I say effort, trust yourself. I think trust in yourself and your decision making, and allowing yourself to commit to those decisions. So that note on the top of my handle sort of taken on that meaning as well. So certainly just having a visual tool of it, as it's always sort of there, because I think has been a big plus for me. But certainly, it's taken on a few meanings at different points.
It's a great little mantra. It's funny actually, because boards has come up a couple of times. I spoke to Alistair Cook, and he enabled Alistair to give that voice a name. So Alistair calls his the Gimp. And that voice that comes up, the voice on your shoulder that's going to chip away and be self-critical and stuff. And it's understanding, isn't it, that it's going to come up. There's nothing you can do about it, but it's going to come up. But it's how you manage it and how you react to it. And not batting it away or trying to suppress it or get rid of it, but just how to manage it. And in terms of, you mentioned that you mindset. And so he said to you about, okay, what do you say to yourself when you're in peak performance, and it was effort. For anyone listening, like how would you encourage someone, or how would you suggest to, if someone's thinking, oh, how do I work out what it is for me when I'm in peak performance? Like, if you could just put in a capsule what you and boards did at that point to work that out, what would you say?
I think it's sort of trying to look at some of your favorite times, your performances, what was it when you're playing your best? And for me, I was like looking back at games I'd played for Somerset and trying to go back and sort of think through, my feelings and my thought processes and those sort of things. And so at my best looks like this. And there was obviously different pieces to that as well. And body language, another big one, when at my best, so that's something I can control, take that out with me. And my mindset of effort is something I can control. So looking back at sort of previous successes and trying to remember feelings, trying to again visualize, like I say, when you were back in that moment, and trying to sort of almost gather back those emotions and those feelings that you had, and then sort of work out a way of sort of just capturing them and then trying to find them, especially then in preparation to go into another game, etc., trying to take yourself back to that place, or more of those feelings that you have when you're in that peak performance place.
That's super interesting. Just to quickly pop back, so we mentioned post 2015, and I know you were dropped soon after that, but actually then you went and you spent a lot of time playing franchise cricket, and you said that actually really benefited you, and you learnt a lot from, for example, playing with the Rajasthan Royals, and you said you learnt a lot about yourself and how to be self-sufficient. So two parts to this question as well, Joss. First of all, actually, with what happened afterwards in terms of the World Cup and everything like that and where you are now, in a way, was that a bit of a blessing to have that time to go and have that franchise cricket, which helped you with your confidence and everything like that? So that's part one. Was it potentially a beneficial period? And secondly, what did you learn about yourself and about confidence and how to be self-sufficient during that period?
Yes, I think that was a really positive effect on me, actually. I think the moment I got dropped actually felt like a huge relief. It felt like I could breathe again. And also, it reminds me about, just quickly on that sort of perspective type thing. You know, at the time, you just thought everyone's talking about you. You thought you go down to breakfast and the chef's probably thinking in his head, oh, he hasn't scored any runs. And the guy you walk past on the streets, oh, that's him. He's in the paper because he's not scoring runs. And then you get dropped. And then you realize actually, like a day later, like no one cares. Like no one's talking about you anymore. And then they're on to the next person. And so that gave me a sense of perspective again. And then going away and learning through the franchise stuff, I think one thing that gave me a lot of confidence from franchise cricket is people asking you questions. You know, suddenly in the IPL, you're playing with some of your heroes, other people you respect so much from around the world and think they're a brilliant player. And then they'll come to you and say, you know, when you do this shot or this thing, how do you do that? And can you tell me about this bit? You sort of have those organic conversations where you sort of, I might show someone something and I'll ask them about a point of their game, and then sort of take quite a lot of confidence from someone you respected a lot or thought, God, he actually wants to know how I do it. Maybe he's not superhuman, and maybe he still has the same sort of inhibitions I do at certain times. And I think then going around the world and sharing dressing rooms with people, you go, oh yeah, everyone's sort of in the same boat. He still worries about getting out first ball as well, or he still battles a few demons in the nets, etc. So you sort of desensitized those thoughts. It certainly took away sort of that fear factor of certain players, because you're suddenly sharing a dressing room with them and go, God, he gets, remember how nervous he got in that game when he was about to bowl, like, you know, so that kind of thing. And I think that period is where I started to sort of really learn well and learn about myself and what, so, you know, picking up certain things and then realizing, okay, don't have to do everything that everyone says, you know, let's try and take something that Ricky Ponting said, did it work for me, and go, actually, yeah, it does. I'm going to try and run with that for a little bit, or that other bit he was on about, I'm not sure that one's for me, so I'm going to leave that. And then certain players, so I really improved, like I said, my learning at that point. And then sort of people, when you play in franchise tournaments, you're obviously turning up to play in a short space of time with some people you don't know. So the head coach will come to you and say, so what do you need from me? And if suddenly you actually go, okay, I actually need to work out what it is that I need to prepare for the game. What is it that makes me tick? What do I need to ask him to get the best out of me? So I think then you start, sometimes with, you know, as a younger player and with England, and so you sort of, as a youngster, you certainly assume that, you know, they'll tell me what I need to do sometimes, or practice has always been done in a certain way. So you sort of feel like, oh, I have to do that, even though I might not particularly want to. So that freedom of someone coming to you and saying, what do you need to get ready for the game, made you sort of really think about that and take ownership of okay, this is what I need for my practice, this is what I like to do. And then it is all on you that if they service you that, then, you know, you have to then go and perform. So I think taking gave me a lot of ownership, suddenly being a bit more independent.
Yeah, ownership, it's a cracking word. And there's actually some really interesting points I just want to quickly pick up on. First of all, realizing that everyone is human, because it's so easy to put people on a pedestal. And again, just to go back to my chat with Alistair Cook and his conversation with Mark Boards, and who said that, yeah, even Barack Obama, when he does public speaking, has his own gimp. And Alistair was like, what, really? You know, like everyone is human and prone to the same self-doubts and you know, self-critical thoughts. We're all one and the same in that regard. And then when you were talking about when you were dropped and you were projecting your thoughts out onto the chef or whatever else, like, I can relate to that, and I'm sure lots of us can too. You know, we have thoughts about ourselves and imagine everyone else's, but the fact is we live in a hugely indifferent world, you know, which is on one hand a bit of a difficult thought almost, to realize that how little people care. But then on the other hand, it's reassuring, because it enables you to actually like do what you've done and get back in touch with that exploration and that exploring, that curious, the young side, and take risks. And because, you know, there's not actually as much to lose as we think. Do you think that's a fair sort of summary?
Yeah, that's a real fair summary. And I think, you know, that can also work the same with success as well. You know, you get to the sort of top of the mountain and sort of say winning the World Cup, for example, was, and then after it, you're like, oh, that was it. You know, that was that moment, which of course was the best moment ever for us. But then it's like, oh, that's it. And it's gone. And then actually sometimes then when you look back, you go, actually, it's more the journey and the sort of process you'll go through. They're the things you sort of really remember. And oh, I remember sort of 2 years ago when we spoke like this in the dressing room, there was a really powerful meeting that everyone had. And it's that sort of journey that they really remember sometimes, as opposed to the sort of peak success. So I think that sort of takes you back to the other side of it again, like you say, how much people don't really, really care. And there's that, there's the book, isn't there? The mindset of not giving a, one thing I sort of took from that book is giving yourself a budget of things that you could actually care about. So sort of in, you know, go throughout your day, the fact that, you know, the lunch wasn't quite ready on time and, you know, it doesn't really matter. So there's other things that I need to worry more about in my life, or the fact that the nets aren't perfect at the ground, you know, it's not ideal, but it doesn't actually matter that much. And it's the same with, you know, how much people sometimes care about certain things. You know, and so the only sometimes thing I sort of battle with that is the success side of it. Because if you say that failing doesn't matter that much, does it sometimes mean that your successes don't really matter that much as well? And you know, I sort of read some Stoic philosophy books and listened to your one with Ryan Holiday and stuff, and there's it's almost like that Zen mindset that there's no highs and lows. And sometimes I look at some guys and think, well, you know, when he's high, he's really high and he's having the best time of his life. And sometimes do you need to be more to get that as well? But then obviously you go through the lows, which you don't want. So I think that's an interesting balance sometimes as well, because you need to make sure you can give yourself the great times that you really enjoy as well. So that's something I always will battle with sometimes.
Yeah, I think that's a really common thing, isn't it? And that success thing you talked about, you know, and with you and the rest of your teammates, which we'll come to in a sec, you know, in terms of reaching the absolute pinnacle, you know, winning a World Cup under the most incredible circumstances ever. And but then understanding that, well, actually, you know, it doesn't actually change me or this or a lot of my life. And, you know, so many people are striving towards goals and this. And Johnny Wilkinson talks about this, you know, this idea that, you know, when I finally reach my goals, everything will be fine and everything will fit into place. But it doesn't happen like that, does it? I mean, as you've just said, you know, you won the World Cup, and then actually it's like, a day later or 2 days later or whatever, people are kind of back to their normal, everything just picks up back where it was.
Yeah, absolutely. And sort of, you know, you suddenly realize, again, it's not the biggest thing for some people. And then, oh, I still feel, you know, nervous. I think I was probably quite naive in the sense that I said a few things that now I feel like you could sort of, I've achieved that thing. I could sort of freewheel the rest of my career. I'll never have another worry about cricket ever again. But then you can, sure as eggs are eggs, the next match, I still had the same anxieties over things. And just because you're now a World Cup winner doesn't mean you walk on water and you don't care anymore, or you don't get those nervous feelings. So that was a real excellent reality check for me. And I think sometimes remembering, like you say, we're all striving for these goals and to try and be the best we can be and get to the, but the mindset of sort of being yourself and being authentic to yourself, I think is that's where the real enjoyment comes, and knowing you did something your way. Because if you're trying to be successful in terms of whether it's money or sort of those real tangible things, there's always someone with more, you know, there's always someone who's got more medals, or there's someone who's won more things or has got more money, or so you never really satisfy yourself. So to try and have a mindset of authenticity and being the best version of you, you know, whether that's being a dad or being one of, you know, when I'm with my mates, being the best mate you can be, or being, and those real intangible things, like you say, and that process of going through it and as of your journey towards success is almost the more enjoyable part of things. You know, Manoj Badali is the owner of the Rajasthan Royals team, and talking to him about his business, he's a lot involved in like tech startups, and in talking to him about, you could just see that glint in his eye. You know, that's the fun is the initial is trying to get there. Can I get this idea or this app to that point? No, it's not when it gets to that point, you're almost like the fun's over, then it becomes a job. But the sort of trying to develop an app and come up with something, or and then working through the the tough times with it and getting it to the next stage. You just saw his sort of face light up talking about that bit, and like that being the main bit of fun that he would have in trying to grow his businesses. And sometimes that's the same in the sport. You know, the journey is the more fun bit, and at times you don't even realize it until you then have to look back on it and go, actually, wow, that was a big moment in our journey as a team. And how much of an impact that had on you as an individual sometimes takes time to sink in.
Absolutely. No, I love that. And it's flicking it round, isn't it? Like there is definitely a common thinking, a way of thinking of, oh, it's in the future. But if you live that way, as they say, you know, you die without eventually living. If you continually live for the future, but if it is the journey and those moments along the way and the excitement of, can I do this? If that's where you find your joy, then you're a spiritual master, I think, essentially. Right. We've got to finish, Joss, just on the final. Obviously, you know, first something actually, I watched an interview of you before the World Cup had even started, and you were talking about how grateful you were for the opportunity of a home World Cup. And I thought, you know, the fact that you saw it as an opportunity and that gratitude really, that must have really set you up really well. But let's move to the final. You scored 59 runs, 110 run partnership with Ben Stokes, the super over, boundary on the final ball. But it is obviously that moment where Jason Roy pings it in, and you've got to catch the ball and knock the bails off. Could you describe what was going through your head at that exact moment as the ball was whistling towards you? Were you free of thought? Were you just focused on the process? What was going through your head at that exact moment?
Yeah, I've been asked that question a lot, and really not a lot was going through my head, but I knew, like you say, you're on that subconscious, you're just doing your thing. Obviously, the consequences are completely different, but in terms of the fielding and the run out, it's actually quite a simple run out, really, to execute. I really remember before Jofra bowled the ball, just sort of thinking to myself, just do your job. Like, you know, whatever happens here, do your job. In a way, you know, don't be the one to mess it up. But just this ball, it's one ball, do your job. Whatever happens, and if the ball comes your way, just do your job. And then sort of in the moment, I knew sort of the ball, you know, you bowled the perfect ball, it'd gone straight to a fielder, and then you sort of switch into the, okay, you've got, actually remember that you've got time, because if there's no way you can get back in time, well, we've got an opportunity. So then you're on that autopilot type where you just collect the ball and take the stumps. It sounds so simple, and it is really, obviously the consequence is different, but it is that simple if you can stay that present and in the moment. So I remember doing that and then sort of breaking the stump. So it's sometimes hard to remember sort of exactly what you were feeling at that moment, and especially with video, you know, you've watched it so many times and you've seen it from sort of that many different angles now to remember what was going through your eyes at the time. But I just remember the 20 seconds of pure elation, having broke the stumps, and everyone charging round, and guys who are running off from the boundary onto the pitch, and all just everyone just that pure sense of elation. And I remember Owen Morgan sort of describing it as, you know, when you're like a kid and you're running down a hill and your legs are just going, you just can't keep up. It's sort of running around the field in that sort of state was absolutely amazing. And I think that's sort of, I remember that feeling more than the actual ball almost.
Yeah. Well, that whole do your job, which was what you were saying to yourself, that is sort of a mantra that focused on the process, kept you in the present, didn't worry too much about the outcome, and therefore you made, you know, a very high consequence situation, but like you say, for you, relatively simple, kept it simple. England won the World Cup, bada bing, all sorted. Anyway, listen, it was a beautiful, beautiful moment. You know, sports fans will never forget that. I remember, what a day, God, that and the Wimbledon final, unbelievable. Anyway, I mean, that's as good a place as any to finish. Joss, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much. You've been full of wisdom, and you know, I've just really enjoyed chatting and hearing your outlook and your approach and the amount of thought that goes into it. It's been fascinating. So thank you very much indeed. It really has been a joy.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of Don't Tell Me The Score. I really hope you enjoyed our conversation, and I would, of course, be delighted to hear your thoughts, ideas, and questions. Do get in touch via my website, simonmundy.com. I do really appreciate you listening. And if you could leave a kind rating and review, I would be sincerely grateful. All that remains is for me to say I hope you'll join me again next time. Until then, thank you and goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.